for coming. And on behalf of Veritas and our partner organizations, welcome to the Round Church and the follow-up debate. My name is Matthew. I'm a PhD student here in the psychology and philosophy departments. As a quick note of housekeeping, if you could all please take this moment to silence any mobile devices you might have, that'd be great. So our debaters tonight are Dr. Arif Ahmed and Professor Tom Simpson, and our moderator is Dr. Jonathan Luce. As a brief introduction to our speakers, many of you may recognize Dr. Luce from the talk he gave in Easter term of last year. That was on philosophy of mind. It was entitled, Persons and Naturalism, Are We Just Matter and Does It Matter? So we're delighted to welcome Dr. Luce back. He's a senior lecturer in philosophy and psychology at Haythorpe College, University of London. He has authored articles in philosophy of mind, philosophy of psychology, and philosophy of religion, and he's currently a visiting scholar here at the University of Cambridge. Dr. Arif Ahmed is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Philosophy here at the University of Cambridge. His main professional interests are Wittgenstein and decision theory, and his recent and forthcoming publications include Wittgenstein, Philosophical Investigations, A Critical Guide, and Evidence, Decision, and Causality. And both of these are available from the Cambridge University Press. Politically libertarian, he is also a local trade union official and caseworker. Theologically, he is an atheist and regularly speaks for atheism in public debate and has debated many of the most prominent theologians, philosophers of religions, apologists, and biblical scholars, which recently include the likes of Professor William Lane Craig and Gary Habermas, Pete Williams, Keith Ward, and Rowan Williams. And many of these debates are available online, and I'd encourage you to check some of them out. Finally, we have Professor Tom Simpson. He's an associate professor of philosophy and public policy at the Blavatnik School of Government, University of Oxford, and also a senior research fellow at Wadham College. He has joined the school from Cambridge, where he was a research fellow at Sydney Sussex College and was also educated for both undergraduate, MPhil, and PhD here at Cambridge. Between degrees, he was an officer with the Royal Marine Commandos for 5 years, and that included tours of Northern Ireland, Iraq, and Afghanistan. His primary research is on trust and the role this plays in transmitting knowledge and on a variety of applied ethical issues. He also works in the areas of ethics of war and religious epistemology. So please join with me in welcoming our speakers.
Great. Well, thank you all very much for coming. Can I just check you can hear me at the back in the round? Just give me a wave or something if you can do that. That seems okay. Great. Well, we hope to have a really interesting discussion this evening. However, it may only need to be quite short. I've just come up on the train from London in this freezing cold weather. The train was on time. Proof positive that miracles happen. Our evening is over. No. So it's... It's very good to be with you, and I hope we'll have a good discussion together. Many of you will have been here on Friday night. Perhaps you could just indicate if you were here on Friday and you heard Professor John Lennox give his talk here in Cambridge. Yeah, so probably about half of you were here for that. Well, I can reassure you if you weren't here that what Arif and Tom will be saying will not be assuming that you were, but I can also reassure you that if you were here that there will be some new thoughts to contemplate this evening as well as we have this discussion together. We wanted this to be a very informal kind of conversation, a very large-scale event on Friday, which inevitably then is more formal. We'd like to give you an opportunity to ask your questions when we've had our discussion time together. So as you're listening to Arif and as you're listening to Tom, please do be thinking about the questions you might ask. But I will just make this request at the start, and that is that if you could keep your questions relatively short, we'll have about 25 minutes to half an hour of discussion. And it will be great to have a number of questions in that time. So we have two lecturers this evening. I've been to events where some members of the audience think that there are more than two lecturers. So if you have a mini lecture to give, please save that for conversation afterwards and give us your questions, and that will be much appreciated. Thank you. So from here, where are we going to go? Well, Arif and Tom will speak one after the other, and we'll give what is effectively their response to the lecture that John Lennox gave on Friday evening. They'll have about 12 minutes each for that, And following that, then, we will have an opportunity for each to respond to what the other has said. So they'll have a slightly shorter time then to respond. So that should take us through 40 minutes, 45 minutes, something like that. And at that point, then, we'll have an opportunity for questions following that. We have two very capable philosophers here. We should have a very, very interesting discussion together. I do note that one is an ex-Marine and the other is trained in kickboxing. So if the discussion gets too heated, I shall be stepping back and I suggest you do the same. But there we are. So you've heard introductions of our two speakers this evening. So it just then falls to me to invite Arif, if you'd like to address us with your response to what Professor Lennox had to say on Friday evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Can you all hear me at the back? Yep, okay, thank you. Well, thanks very much to the Veritas Forum for its invitation. Thank you, Matthew, for your introduction. And thank you all for coming. Looking forward to the debate tonight. As John said, I shall be talking mostly about Professor Lennox's very stimulating and interesting talk on Friday night. But as I know many of you won't have attended it, everything I say about it I shall preface with a short account, my own account, which might be contentious, of what the content was of what he said. Before I do any of that, I just want to say a little bit about what I myself believe in the view that I'm going to be defending tonight. My position is indeed an atheist position. I don't believe in the truth of any religion. I think all religions are false. I also think all religions are harmful, but that's not a question that we're going to discuss tonight, or at least I'm not going to talk about it in this part of my talk. So I don't believe in any sorts of spirits. I don't believe in any sort of magic. I don't believe in God or divine creation of the world, any sorts of miracles, or Allah, or the Jewish God, or any of the Hindu gods, or any of the other more recent forms of superstition that have existed in Europe and other parts of the world for thousands of years, maybe 10,000 such religions, and in my view, they're all false, not all but one, as many people think. Now, I'm going to say a little bit more about what I think in connection with John Lennox's description of the view that he calls naturalism. And then after that, I'm going to talk about three other points that John Lennox made. One of those is to do with an argument that he made that naturalism, as he describes it, involves a certain kind of faith, just as much as religion does. The second one is to do with the fact that, with the claim, according to him, that naturalism is inconsistent with science itself. And then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about David Hume and miracles. So to start then with Lennox's characterization of naturalism, I think what John Lennox says is that naturalism, which he runs together with atheism, is the same thing as materialism, which is the view that everything is matter, and reductionism, which is the same thing as saying that everything can be reduced to and explained in terms of the movements of little bits of matter, and determinism, which is the view that everything that happens is completely determined by a cause in advance of it. Now, these are all very different doctrines, and one doesn't have to hold all of them to be reasonably called a naturalist or an atheist. Let me just say for myself that I'm certainly not a materialist in the sense that I don't think that everything is made of matter. Okay? I mean, for a start, I think that there are numbers. I believe that there's a number between 11 and 13. I don't know what you think, but I do. And I don't think it's a material object. Why do I believe it? Well, because it's part of my mathematical theory. Why do I believe the mathematical theory? Well, because it's part of science. Why do I believe that part of science? Because experience confirms it. And here we come to the basis of my own view of the world, which is that our best way to understand the world, our best way to approach something like knowledge of it, is through testing against experience. It is certainly by far, ladies and gentlemen, as you all know, the most successful way of finding out anything. All of our science, all of our medicine, all of our mode of transportation, all of our weaponry, all of the great technologies that we have, which have made the Western world what it is, are based on testing against experience. If there's any other form of finding out about reality that has anything like that track record of success, then I'd very much like to hear about it tonight. The main point that I want to make out of that, however, is simply that view, which is called empiricism, and is my form of naturalism, has got nothing to do with the sort of crude reductive materialism with which John Lennox either confused or conflated it. Okay, let me move on to some of the arguments that he made now. One of the arguments that he made was that the practice of science itself involves a kind of faith, a faith that's comparable to the sorts of faith with which atheists often deride the religious as having. What did he mean by that? Well, what he said was that in order to do any science at all, and I think here he quoted Einstein, but I can't remember the exact content of the quote, but he said in order to do any science at all, you have to have a faith that the universe is, as he called it, rationally intelligible. Okay? Without that faith, you couldn't do the scientific experiments. But that faith itself can't be proved by science. That faith is something that we bring to our experimentation and is as much a blind faith as the spiritual beliefs of the religious. That claim is plainly false. If John Lennox could, or perhaps Professor Simpson could mention one experiment that could not have been run by somebody who wasn't sure whether the universe was intelligible, or who didn't know, who was going to put it to the test, if there's a single experiment that actually requires you to believe that, then I'd like to hear about it. Here's an example of an experiment, the Milgram experiment. That's a well-known psychological experiment, most of you will have heard of it. That didn't require the faith that the universe is rationally intelligible, whatever that's supposed to mean. All it required was that if you do these tests on these human subjects, then you might be able to get a fairly good prediction of how other human subjects will behave on other occasions. Here's another experiment, Galileo dropping weights off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. That didn't require faith that the universe is rationally intelligible, whatever that's supposed to mean. All it required was an expectation, which experience proved to be correct, that the behaviour of weights when dropped off one fairly high body on the surface of the Earth would give us a reasonable prediction of the behaviour of weights when dropped off other ones in similar locations. So the claim that he made that it requires faith to do any sorts of experiments is plainly false. The second argument that I want to discuss was a very interesting one, which concerns the view that, as he said, naturalism is actually inconsistent with science. And the example he gave was when he said he would talk to physicists or other experimentalists and say, what's the thing that you do the experiments with? And they would say, my mind, and then they would stop themselves, and instead of saying my mind, they would say, oh, well, actually, it's my brain. And then John Lennox would say, aha, you mean the product of millions of years of blind chance? And they would say, yes, but then he would say, but why do you trust that? Now, the point of the argument, I think, was supposed to be that since the human brain is, according to the evolutionary theory, merely the product of blind chance, random product of blind chance, why should we trust it? So if you do believe your brain functions in that, came to be in that way, that's your theory of the brain, then you shouldn't think that thinking and reasoning and other things get you to the truth. So you shouldn't employ reasoning in the first place, or any of the other forms of cogitation that are involved in scientific inquiry. Well, this is a very interesting argument. I think it will be misunderstood by some people and ridiculed by others, so it's quite important to understand exactly what it's saying. One thing that did occur to me, I think, was that if Lennox is right, then what he says about the brain is actually the least of our concerns. You think about my eye, for instance. And my eye is telling me that there's a lamp over there. My eye is the product of millions of years of blind chance, evolution. Why should I trust it? Why should I think my eye does tell me that there's a light over there? So it's not just science that's going to have to go on this view, it's the evidence of our senses as well. And perhaps that reveals the actual underlying fallacy in this argument, which is that calling something the product of blind chance is in one way highly misleading, because it makes it seem as though its deliverances are entirely random, and it's as likely to give any of an infinite number of false conclusions as it is to give a true one. And the reason why calling it blind chance is misleading is because although it is indeed true that mutations are random in evolution, so that the genetic stock changes by mutation in a more or less random way, the direction in which it changes is most certainly not random. The direction in which it changes is a product of pressures of natural selection, which would, of course, select four organs that are pretty good at doing various jobs. The reason my eye is trustworthy, even though it's a product of blind chance, is because the kind of blind chance it's the product of is millions and millions and millions of trials of trial and error, where the ones that don't work very well get weeded out, and only the ones that are successful, or relatively successful, are allowed to continue and improve. So if you imagine, for instance, a blind drunken sailor walking down an alley, and there are two walls on either side of him, eventually, as he meanders his way, he's going to get to one end or the other end of the alley, and he's going to get out of the alley, even if he does it by random, simply because the paths that don't lead out of the alley are eventually going to be terminated. So there's no reason to think that the brain, simply because it's the product of blind evolution, as he calls it, isn't a good guide to truth. It's exactly what you would expect, that the sort of organ that can find the truth and discover things is the one that's going to give an advantage in the struggle for survival to its bearer. So evolution itself tells us, I think, that we have every reason to trust the brain without belief in any sort of supernatural guarantor for it. Let me turn now finally to John Lennox's discussion of Hume on miracles. I was perplexed by this, because what he discussed, for those of you who weren't there, what Lennox discussed was the following arguments of Hume, the argument that the people who were present at the resurrection, the alleged resurrection of Christ, were people who came from an uneducated time where everyone believed in miracles. That was one argument. And the second argument was that miracles are a violation of a law of nature, and laws of nature are by definition uniform, and therefore a miracle couldn't happen. This was extraordinary, because Hume's most famous and most powerful argument against miracles was neither of those things. It's perfectly true that he says those things, and the oddity was compounded by the fact that Lennox mentioned a work of Hume's called Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, but of course the argument that Hume gives, the key argument against miracles, is not there, it's in The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. Let me now say what that argument is, the one that Lennox did not address, so you don't need to have heard the talk to understand this. Hume's argument is perfectly general and is directed not towards the claim that miracles are impossible, but towards the claim that it is never rational to believe testimony in a miracle. Testimony is our only source of evidence for the miracles that are at the center of the Christian religion, or indeed of many other religions. Islam is a very good example. And what Hume says is the following. He says, whenever somebody tells you that a miraculous event has occurred, you have to ask yourself which one is more likely. Is it more likely that this person is either insincere or mistaken? That's one possibility. Or is it more likely that a man came back from the dead? Now, how do we tell which of two events is more likely? Well, our best way of telling is to ask which kind of thing happens more frequently. Okay? Now, it's admitted on all sides, every religious person must admit, as well as every irreligious person, that 99.99% of testimonies to religious claims are false. Okay? All Christians must believe that Muhammad was lying or deceived when he said that he met an angel in a cave. Okay? All Muslims must believe that the 500 people St. Paul mentions, 513 people St. Paul mentions, were wrong, were either lying or deceived when they said they saw Jesus come back from the grave. So everyone believes that false, whether because they were sincere but mistaken, or whether they involved deceit, it doesn't matter, but false claims to resurrection or other miracles are far more frequent than actual miraculous occurrences. Even if you count the small number of exceptions like Lazarus and Samuel and so on in the Bible, the number of resurrections that occur, even according to Christians or Jews, can presumably be counted on the fingers of one hand. The number of mistaken testimonies numbers in the billions. All right, so let's go back to Hume's argument. We know which kind of event is more frequent. Which kind of event in this particular case, therefore, is more likely? And the answer now, the question basically answers itself. Of course you should think, if any person tells you that this or that man rose from the dead, you should think without further ado that it's far more likely that the person is either lying or mistaken than that this particular miraculous event occurred. And of course, that is exactly what we do in all of these cases. If 500 people watch David Copperfield make the Eiffel Tower vanish, and they say, oh, look, I saw it on the telly, he made the Eiffel Tower vanish, or even in the audience, no, none of you would, quite sensibly, none of you would think for a moment that David Copperfield made the Eiffel Tower vanish. You would think that there was some very elaborate trickery going on. There are thousands of witnesses to the resurrection of Elvis. There are thousands of statements from people who saw him in France, in England, in Memphis, in Kabul even. There's a statement I read recently, and he said he worked in a foreign aid agency in Kabul, and he said, I saw Elvis. He was wearing a beard and heavily disguised, but he was there. This is about 10 years ago. All of you react to that perfectly sensibly. Hume's argument is that that is perfectly sensible and has a perfectly rational backing. Now, that argument was not addressed at all by Lennox, and I hope we can discuss that one a bit more today. Hume concludes his essay with the viciously ironic claim that, in fact, there is a miracle in Christianity. The miracle is that people still believe it. Now, the way he puts it can also be taken seriously. It can be taken as saying, well, actually, it's the operation of the Holy Spirit. It's the operation of the Holy Spirit that makes one believe in spite of rationality. And you can think that if you want, but don't mistake that for thinking that there's genuine rationality going on where one maintains the beliefs of the Christian religion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Arif. So straight over then to Tom for his presentation in response to what John Lennox had to say.
Great. Well, thank you. Arif, is this working at the back? You picking it up. Thank you, Ruth, for those stimulating remarks. And as I was doing my YouTube research beforehand, debates were always characterised as Lennox versus Martin Luther, for instance. And I was pleased to see the poster was Simpson and nonetheless, in the spirit of disinterested search for truth, here are some reflections. And I'd like to start, if I may, just by picking up is that working?
Great, thank you. I'd like to start, if I may, with some remarks that John Lennox made about the nature of belief and faith. And this is really to try and identify where I think the substantial disagreement will lie between Arif and myself. So, there's a very neutral sense of the word belief. So Arif prefaces remarks by saying, this is what I believe. And by that he means assent to certain propositions. So there's some claims, and both the Christian and the non-Christian, the atheist, believer in another religion, assent to certain claims. There's certain things you take to be true, and that's just neutral for everyone contributing to the debate. There's another sense in the word faith, which I think is worth picking out, and this is that there are some, if you like, there are some fundamental claims which colour the way that you look at the world. So they almost function as a kind of interpretative grid through which you understand reality. And Willard Van Orman Quine, who was a prominent 20th century philosopher, used the image of a web of belief to describe some beliefs which are at the centre of your understanding of the world and others which are more peripheral. And most people, it seems to me, do, just as a matter of fact, have these kind of core beliefs at the centre of the way they think about the world. And part of what it is to examine your belief structure is to work out what are those central commitments that play that role and take them from being implicit, unstated assumptions and to subject them to examination, to rational scrutiny. And I think in that sense of the word faith, Arif and I would also both be in agreement that just descriptively this is the case for a lot of people, and the work of philosophy, of theology, of reflection is to test which ones ought to be endorsed. There's a third sense, or rather a further sense of the word faith, which is also necessary to highlight, and is not shared between Christians and atheists. And this is the sense of the word which derives from fides, the Latin, which refers to trust and to loyalty. And when you trust someone, this could be a mark either of a kind of interpersonal relationship. So when a marriage is good, there's trust between the two spouses. And it can also be a source of knowledge. So when I trust what someone else says, I can come to believe on the basis of trusting them. Now, atheism can't ultimately be a matter of trust in that sense. So although maybe you're cognitively challenged and some other smart philosopher has done the thinking for you and tells you all the evidence that God doesn't exist, you might believe that God doesn't exist on the basis of Arif telling you. That would be testimonially based belief. But Arif would have had to have worked out for himself that God didn't exist for that to be a rational attitude on your part. Atheism ultimately cannot be a matter of faith in this sense. Now, it seems to me this is not true for theistic religions, and particularly for Christianity. For any revealed religion, this is not true. Where it is possible that there be both a relationship between the believer and God, which is one of trust, and actually that the source of knowledge can ultimately be one of trust. And where the disagreement certainly is here is that Arif thinks that that can never be a rational attitude to have. And I disagree. I think it can be a rational attitude. And I'm going to explain why I think that is the case now. So this is going a bit further beyond what John was saying. And I just say as well, I'm confining my remarks here to the positive case, and then I'm going to pick up Arif's comments in the rebuttal after he's replied. So why is this a rational attitude to have? I'm going to give you two analogies which try and make the point. Analogy is never perfect, but they try and capture the central points. So Jesus says a bunch of stuff, and each of us, when you read that, you read it in the Gospels, has a decision to make. Do I believe this or not? Pretty simple decision. And there are two questions that that comprises. So the first is, how do I know that Jesus said what he's reported as saying? And then the other one is, if I know that this is what Jesus says, should I believe it, given that? Okay, let me deal with the first one. In this respect, there is an act of trust involved. So there's an act of trust in the sense that you have to rely on the preservation of the Gospels through time, for about 2,000 years. And then you have to rely on the writers of the Gospels having spoken truthfully about what happened. Now, I'm a philosopher, I'm not a biblical studies expert, but the textual evidence that we have for both the transmission is absolutely of a par with our classical sources. And the breadth of testimony to Jesus' life is, again, absolutely of a par. So here's the analogy. Suppose Winston Churchill says, winning the Second World War depended on, say, a core intelligence decision, which Churchill took in 1943, just for the sake of argument's sake, just like that. You would have to work out, do I have good reason to think that Churchill said that? What you might do is line up five biographies, and you can read them and test them. And you don't have to have full agreement between all the five biographies. It's just sufficient that the five biographies converge in the essentials on the kinds of things that Churchill has said, and repeat, in some sense, the key points, the high points. So that's the first analogy. My claim is that the act of reliance for what Jesus said is diffused across a community, and that gives it greater validity. Here's the second, in some sense, more substantial claim. And let me give the analogy first. So, it's 1969. No one's been to the moon. No one knows what the far side, the dark side of the moon is like. And Pink Floyd are not the best guide to the dark side of the moon. Neil Armstrong is. So suppose for the sake of argument, Armstrong obviously did touch down, and suppose he had a little buggy and he could drive over to the dark side of the moon, and he came back and said, there's a lake of ice on the far side of the moon. No one else has ever been there. We've got no other way of corroborating what's gone on. Each of us then has a decision. Do I believe what Armstrong has said? Armstrong is, in this respect, a privileged witness. There's no other way to confirm what he said other than through believing Armstrong. And we're going to test, is Armstrong sincere? So is he lying? And does he know what he's talking about? And it gets even more complicated, because it may even be that in order for us to know what he's talking about, we have to rely on Armstrong being sincere. So if Armstrong says, look, the grid coordinates are X and Y, you know, it's right sort of in the middle of the far side of the moon, he's giving you his credentials, but you have to rely on him knowing for himself and then not lying to you that he's competent on what he knows. So with a privileged witness, the person's moral character becomes of decisive significance for the validity of your believing what they've testified to. And my claim is that Jesus' testimony tells us a bunch of things about the nature of God, his coexistence with the Father from eternity, have this character. They're of a privileged variety. Only Jesus can speak to them. And let me just...
How long have I got? Just
You have another 2 minutes.
Okay. Let me just say very quickly why... we're going to come... Hume's argument is going to show up more because it's a really important one. And there's a lot to say about it. But can I just say very quickly, it seems to me that Hume's argument does not apply in this instance. And the reason for that is as follows. So, the claims that are at stake with Jesus' testimony are of this kind of fundamental reality-shaping variety, whether or not God exists. All the natural evidence that we have, so the evidence about the way the world works, the laws of physics, etc., is systematically ambiguous, it seems to me, between God's existing or God's not existing. We're not able to give a credence, we're not able to assign a prior probability to whether or not God exists. And because we can't assign a prior probability to that, we don't have anything on that side of the scale to weigh against the likelihood of Jesus' testimony being insincere or incompetent. So the weighing of the scales of the two probabilities that Arif identified can't be done in this situation because we don't have anything to plug in on the priors on that side. So there'll be more to talk to about that, but that's my initial claim for why Hume's argument does not apply in this situation. So let me conclude. John Lennox gave three categories of evidence. He gave history, science, and experience. And the coherence of Christianity across all three of those gives extra support to the truth of Christianity if you already have good reason to believe that Christianity is true. And what I'm proposing is that that good reason is given if you believe someone who knows what they're talking about and testifies sincerely, and that is indeed the case, I propose, with Jesus. So, it's really simple. So, and it shouldn't be surprising that it should be really simple. The question is, do you believe what Jesus said? And that's a question that's accessible to everyone, regardless of whether you've got a doctorate, whether you've got two GCSEs and are a welder. You know, like, that's completely impartial. Do you believe what this person has said because of who the person is who has said it? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, very much. think it was one of the Republican candidates in the US election last week that stated that America needs welders more than it needs philosophers. Gives the three of us something to think about. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Arif, for your alternate responses to what John has said. Arif, I'm just going to give you then another 10 minutes or so, less if you don't need it, but to respond to what Tom has said about testimony and other aspects of what John has said. And then we'll go over and do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom. That was terrific and gave me a lot to think about, so that's great. I think I'll start with some comments on Tom's first analogy. This is the analogy with Churchill. And in fact, the first thing I wanted to say wasn't actually about the content of the analogy itself, but about the decision that Tom represents us as having to make. What he said is that when somebody says something to you, you have to make a decision as to whether or not to trust that person. I think this simplifies things in a way that's quite important for understanding Hume's argument, because it's not simply a question of either I trust this person or I don't, so that the choice is between complete and unthinking credulity on the one hand and blanket rejection on the other. That choice isn't what happens, and it certainly isn't what happens in real life most of the time. Whenever you read a newspaper or hear, for instance, a politician speaking on television, or hear somebody that you know, though perhaps to a smaller degree if you know the person very well, you will form some degree of confidence in the truth of what they say, depending on a variety of factors. These factors include facts about the person's position to know the thing that they're talking about. They include facts about their own competence and their own background. Crucially, they also include facts about the content of what that person is saying, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The important point I wanted to start out by making, however, was that it's simply not true to say that one faces a decision when one hears testimony on any matter simply between trusting the person or rejecting what they say. That is certainly not what happens most of the time. Life would be very much more difficult if it were. Moving on to the analogy with Churchill a little bit more closely, if the claim is that in order to tell whether Churchill said X, Y, or Z, we have to look at the testimony of various historians or people who were there and so on, that's perfectly true. And it would be quite reasonable if five witnesses, for instance, said that Churchill, Churchill knew that Coventry was going to be bombed but didn't want it evacuated because then the Germans would know we'd cracked Enigma or whatever it was. That's something that could have happened. Historical testimony will tell us, or will give us some good idea whether it happened. Perhaps we can never be 100% certain, but we can be as confident as we might need for most purposes that that did happen. I've no idea whether it did or not, but that's just an example. That's perfectly true. However, in the case where what's being testified to is an event of such astonishing improbability, given the frequency with which these things occur, we have to be much more sceptical of what these witnesses say. If we'd had five witnesses who hadn't said Churchill refused to evacuate Coventry, but we'd instead had five witnesses who said Churchill turned into a lizard on this particular day, I don't think five witnesses, even if one of them was, I don't know, Hugh Trevor Roper or someone, would be enough to give us the slightest degree of confidence in what was being said. So the mere numbering of convergent witnesses cannot by itself overcome the improbability of the thing that's being claimed. Just as an aside on that point, I should also say that the biblical witnesses were, of course, eyewitnesses, and it's well known to anyone who has dealings with courts or any forensic matters at all that eyewitnesses are, in fact, notoriously bad sources of evidence when it comes to matters of criminal courts. They may, and they often do, convince juries, but there are very many convictions that have later been shown to be unsafe on the basis of DNA and other evidence which were based on the confident and often independent testimony of eyewitnesses. One of the reasons for this, of course, is that, as plenty of studies have shown, eyewitnesses who are in situations of stress, as one often is when one's at the scene of a crime, are very bad at identifying people, even in good light, even when they're relatively close distance from them. Now, of course, the people who testified to Jesus coming back from the grave were, of course, understandably, in a situation of great stress, quite aside from anything else that one might say about how interested they were in this thing's being true. So I think we have plenty of independent evidence to distrust what they say, even if there were 513 of them, not just 5 or 12. and also quite independently the extraordinary content of the claim that was being made. Now, I was going to say something about the analogy with Neil Armstrong, but actually in some ways there's relatively little that I have to say about that that adds to what I said about Churchill. Of course, if Armstrong had said, you know, there's a lake of ice on the other side of the moon, then, you know, we would have no reason to be especially doubtful. If Armstrong had said something like, I met Jesus on the other side of the moon, and he said, give all your money to Neil Armstrong, then he, of course, is in just as good a position. He's in a much better position than anyone else to know what was on the other side of the moon. But strangely enough, I expect far fewer people would believe him if he'd said that, rather than if he'd said there's a lake of ice on the other side of the moon. And in a way, I suppose this illustrates my point that the degree of confidence in which you put in what somebody says when they testify to something depends in part not only on how well-placed the person was, but on the content of what they were saying as well, which in itself, of course, can modify your confidence in them being well-placed to or a competent judge of what they saw. Moving on now to one of the things that Tom said about Hume's argument. What he said towards the end was that Hume's argument doesn't apply. Let me just rehearse what the argument was. The argument was, the one premise was, if somebody testifies to something, you have to ask, what's more likely? Is it that the person's mistaken or lying on the one hand, or is it that this thing actually happened? Second premise was, the thing that's more likely is the thing that happens much more often in other cases. Okay? Conclusion, in the case of a resurrection, a mistake, deceit, or some other kind of sincere mistake is much more likely than the person's telling the truth. Now, that argument is valid. It is valid if you also assume that resurrections happen far less frequently than mistakes, which I think everyone agrees with. But I wasn't quite sure from Tom's comments which of the premises of that argument he disagrees with. I mean, does he deny that resurrections happen much less often than mistakes? Or does he deny that we should see what's more likely on the basis of which one happens more often? Or does he deny that we ought to ask which one is more likely, that the person is mistaken, or that the thing actually happened? He has to deny one of those things if he's going to reject Hume's conclusion, because Hume's conclusion does follow from Hume's premises. Now, moving on to the substance of what Tom said, he made the statement that when it comes to religious matters, we can't reasonably assign any prior probability or confidence in the religious hypothesis. Well, let's see now. One thing I might say is simply that the argument, as I presented it, and certainly as Hume presented it, wasn't directed at the sort of catch-all supernatural hypothesis that there's a spiritual meaning to the universe and it's God and it created the universe. It was simply the hypothesis that in a certain part of Judea 2,000 years ago, a man was put to death and that man came back to life. Okay, that's a perfectly specific and local hypothesis about a series of events that happened at a particular time and place. And just as we can ask about any other historical event, whether or not it happened, we can ask about that historical event, whether or not it happened. And of course, we should apply our same canons of historical reason to that as we do to anything else. Now, as to the claim as to whether one can have a prior confidence in God's existence, I'm not entirely sure what it is that's stopping one from having a prior confidence in God's existence. Well, I certainly have a prior probability in God's existence, which happens to be pretty low, but even if it hadn't been pretty low, even if it had been reasonably high, what I don't see is why any of the evidence from Scripture or any of the other sources of evidence that have been cited in the 2,000 years since Jesus' life should increase it at all. So anyone who claims that we actually have evidence that would make a rational person convinced that the central claims of Christian religion are true, just as we do have evidence that would make such a person convinced that aeroplanes fly and rain falls from the sky and trees don't talk and all of the other things that we have plenty of evidence for. If somebody says that we have similar sorts of evidence for this particular claim concerning the Christian religion, or indeed for the general truth of the Christian religion, that's something which it seems to me hasn't been established tonight, and certainly there was nothing in John Lennox's talk either, which gives me the slightest reason to believe it. So to sum up, I think actually one way to sum up would be in terms of the three-part division that Tom mentioned at the very end. Jelinek gave arguments based on science, based on history, and based on personal experience. The arguments concerning science were the ones to do with naturalism and science, which I discussed in my opening talk. The arguments to do with history were the ones to do with the evidence from the Bible and the Gospels and so on, which I discussed in connection with Hume's argument. The arguments concerning experience are not really so much arguments, I think, as spectacular instances of confirmation bias, whereby one thinks that because there are various events that are nice and that happen and that can therefore be put down to a Christian God, one doesn't think that all of the other things that are dreadful and that also happen don't derogate from one's belief in that. So those arguments from experience, I think John Lennox was right not to emphasise greatly, at least not to give much space to in his talk, and certainly there aren't ones that I want to spend too much time on right now, but I'm happy to discuss those in the Q&A later. Thank you.
Thank you, Arif.
Great, thank you. So I'll try and be relatively concise so we can get on to Q&A. And I'm going to start just by picking up some points that Arif made in the first contribution and then defending in slightly more depth what I went on to say. So Arif picked up John for his claim that to do science you have to have kind of faith. And I think, I certainly agree with Arif that, you know, there's a pile of experiments you can do without really having any formed thoughts about reason and the structure of the universe, and that just shows that we've been very effective at identifying a methodology that you can apply and get doctorates out of, but really reflecting on the kind of deep metaphysics of what's at stake. I think what's behind John's remarks there is a claim about induction. So this is, Hume is kind of the patron saint of Cambridge and Cambridge philosophy. And this is another overlooked bit of Hume called the problem of induction, where Hume says, look, you know, the sun has always risen for the last X many thousand years, million years. This gives us no ground whatsoever in reason for predicting that the sun will also rise tomorrow. It's just radically underdetermined by the evidence, and try as he might, Hume struggles to find a rational justification for why we rely on induction, the practice of assuming that the future will resemble the past. And like it or not, the practice of science does rely on the rationality of induction, and that is something that is at least at first glance lacking justification on a atheistic picture. Now, you can do science as a thought-through atheist, just taking it as a working hypothesis that the world carries on running in the way that it kind of always has and the natural laws apply. But that's very different from the kind of expectation, the kind of assurance that the early scientists displayed. So, and it's worth just teasing out in a little bit more detail what was behind John's claim that science is originally a theistic endeavour. So, at the heart of the birth of modern science was a revolution in instruments. So it's not enough just for me to look at the world. In order for me to do an experiment, I have to have an instrument to measure what the angles are, what temperatures are, etc. So the development of science goes hand in hand with the development of instruments which permit measurement. Now that was based historically on a theological commitment to the fallenness of human senses. So because human senses were imperfect representations of reality, we needed instruments to correct and modify that error. And Francis Bacon in The New Organon, just go to the end, is totally explicit that the theological claim drives the experimental method. Now, Arif won't be so blind as to say, well, look, you know, you have to have the theological commitment in order to get the justification of using instruments. But it remains the case that the theological picture of the world was what generated that early scientific method. And I make the point just to illustrate what I think is a kind of more widespread theme running through this dialogue. I made the claim that it seems to me that the natural world has this systematic ambiguity, systematic, it can be read in two ways. And science, the practice of science, is clearly deeply, not just consistent, it's not just compatible with theism, with Christian belief, it's deeply coherent with it as well. Conversely, if you live in a world where God doesn't exist and you sort of look at the world through those lens, science is a kind of never-ending process of confirmation that we live on a bare rock and we're kind of slightly astonishing marvels that consciousness could have emerged out of a primordial soup. And I think behind that is this kind of difficulty of entering the thought world of another, where what looks to someone sitting from one place as confirmatory of a particular view to someone else has absolutely no support. I think that cuts both ways, actually. The kind of imaginative ability to enter the thought world of the other is at a premium. Okay, so that's the first reflection on that. Okay, the second one. So Arif picked up what's called Darwin's doubt. So Darwin's doubt from Darwin is, look, you know, if our brains just emerge from evolution, how is it that we can trust that they track onto the world? And Arif gave the counterexample, well, look, you know, our senses, evolution will select for senses, you know, sight, taste, touch, which tracks onto the world. So, you know, I don't want to be eaten by tigers. It's really good if I see tigers or hear them before they catch me. So evolution selects for people with good hearing, etc. Okay, undoubtedly so. But there's a modified version of the argument which will say, look, okay, sensory experience of the world, sensory apparatus, is going to be selected for by evolution. The evolutionary timescale that it works on is thousands to tens to hundreds of thousands of years. The emergence of reason and science has not been adaptive until about sort of 400 or 500 years. You know, that's the kind of timescale that we've got to see the real fruits of reason coming through. Evolution gives us no reason to think that our higher order capabilities are going to track the truth, track reality in any strong sense. So there's a revised, modified version of the argument which takes account of Arif's reply. Now, I'm actually not sure what I think about that argument. So I sort of haven't really thought about it hard enough, or the time that I spent thinking about it, I can sort of see how it might go both ways. But I'm very happy with that. And in a way, it's an illustration of another point, which is that people often think the burden of proof is on the theist, or that there's a kind of closed-minded need for the theist to be able to make the evidence fit their categories. And on some kind of areas of inquiry, it's definitely the case that some, as it were, intellectual options are closed down. But by no means all. There's other areas of inquiry where being a theist, being a Christian, leaves open areas of inquiry which the naturalist is committed to a certain kind of answer, but the theist is not. So I'm relaxed about whether or not Darwin's doubt applies at that higher level. Okay, let me move on to Hume's argument. Try and structure my thoughts. Okay, so Hume's argument has to be false. And I'm going to give you two reasons for why Arif should think that as well. And I haven't worked out exactly where the falsity lies, but I'll leave that to Arif. I'll see if he can find it. Now, here are the two reasons it has to be false. So imagine the Archangel Gabriel appeared to you and said, I know you've been thinking about whether or not Christianity is true. I'm here to tell you it is. And you're sort of having this visionary experience, and Hume's demon, maybe that's too loaded already, appears on your shoulder and says, aha, you have experience of your senses deceiving you. is it more likely? And we know a priori that visions are rare, and we know that, but we know there's relative sort of, our senses deceive us at relatively frequent intervals. Regardless of what it seems to you like is happening, it is not rational for you to believe that you're having a vision of the Archangel Gabriel. And run this for whatever you want. You know, you die, you appear at the pearly gates, and Peter's there, and Hume's demon says to you, look, you know, we have experience of our senses deceiving us. It's not rational for you to believe this. And there comes a stage where it has become unfalsifiable. It has become contrary to all the possible evidence. So that is an indicator that something has gone wrong in the argument at some stage. It's what philosophers call a reductio ad absurdum. It has absurd consequences. And here's the second reason why Arif should absolutely resist endorsing the argument. Okay, science in everyday life all the time throws up what you might call astonishing reports or surprising reports. So just from everyday life, I don't know, I had a life-changing experience recently. I read Moby Dick from cover to cover, superb novel. And those of you who know it will know that running through it is the white whale. Has anyone seen the white whale? And whales aren't white. But sure enough, there is a white whale, the murderous Moby Dick. And there's a kind of closed-mindedness which refuses to allow the possibility of surprising things happening. And therefore, whatever our norms, our epistemic norms, which calibrate what testimony we should accept, as a society, we have to be able, as individuals, to recognise things that are surprising, that don't fit with our past experience, but which nonetheless are true, and we want to be able to be put in touch with the truth when that occurs. And exactly the same is true for science. So science is full of all kinds of crazy, outlandish ideas. They're borne out by the evidence, and that's fantastic. But you need, if you're not capable of evaluating the evidence for yourself, you're in a position of reliance on the testimony of the scientist in that case. So the norm cannot be one of the thoroughgoing scepticism that Hume alleges. So just a bit of closing intellectual context. If you're in doubt about what Hume says, a good place to go is Thomas Reid, who was his contemporary critic up in Scotland. And Reid and Hume frame what's now called the epistemology of testimony. And Hume's epistemology of testimony is reductionist. It has this central principle of scepticism. Whereas Reid argues that there's a default assumption of trust, absent reasons to the contrary. And it would be, I think, a poor outcome for atheism were it to turn out that it was reliant on a reductionist and unduly sceptical attitude towards testimony. So there's more to be said, but let me finish there and look forward to the Q&A.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom, very much. Well, we've heard two very distinct responses to the lecture on Friday evening, and then we've heard rebuttals of those responses. And now it's time to open up the discussion so that you can contribute with questions and thoughts that have arisen, and perhaps Tom and Arif as well, an opportunity to put what you take to be your most important points direct to one another in conversation as well. But let's just begin. Just raise a hand and I'll... there's a microphone that can come to you and you can raise a question. So we have a question at the back there. If the microphone could just go between the two pillars at the back. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you both for coming tonight and talking. I'm curious about what it feels like to inhabit both of your positions, that being an atheist and a Christian. So I'm not really curious about what you think or believe, but it's always difficult for people to get in someone else's shoes and know what it actually feels like day to day, to get up and go to bed and feel different things and encounter different people. So if you could both just offer your thoughts.
Briefly, does anyone want to take that first? Arif, yeah.
Okay, I'm happy to start. Yeah, well, being an atheist feels great, is the first thing I'll say. I did have a religious upbringing, and I have a sort of religious background when I was a child, and you might be expecting me to, well, I don't know, probably don't expect anything, but yeah, I might have said, oh, I had a great feeling of liberation when I stopped being religious and I felt sort of freedom and it was claustrophobic, but that's not true. It was not as though my own religious background made me feel terribly oppressed or anything like that. I found there was kindness and generosity as well as great intelligence amongst people who are religious, as much as amongst people who weren't. So it's not as though I feel especially at home being an atheist rather than being religious. I should say I wish that the claims of religion were true. I think it'd be great if I came back to life after I died, and also wish that a great deal of wickedness on this earth would be punished, and I know that it wouldn't be, so there's a certain sense of dissatisfaction there. But on the whole, I wouldn't, at least for myself, I'm very glad that I am an atheist.
Thank you, Arif. Tom?
Don't quite know where to begin. I think there's one of the things that's essential to the lived experience of being a Christian is one of transcendence, so that as an individual you don't belong. I don't belong to myself in some fundamental sense. I'm a member of both a community of people, but ultimately defined in relation to God. And I think that's deep, just has sort of very pervasive impacts onto how you live your life. It's fun.
So, Tom, thank you. Thoughtful question to begin. Another question. Yeah, over here at the front, I think the microphone may come around, or if not, if you just want to ask it, I can repeat the question. And here it comes. Great.
Dr. Ahmed, you said that you don't need to believe that faith in faith that the universe is rationally intelligible, but only to have the expectation that one experiment will behave like another under similar conditions. I'm confused as to why these aren't both the same thing. Could you offer a distinction?
Certainly, if you think they're the same thing, if that's all that's involved, then I'm not clear why the attitude you're supposed to take is properly called faith. That is to say, one can suspect or reasonably expect or have a certain degree of confidence that outside of laboratory conditions things will behave much the same way as they do inside laboratory conditions, but that's something that can then be further tested by experience. And indeed, replicability is not a presupposition, but it's something that gives experiments their point. And as we know in social psychology and elsewhere, there's a crisis right now because many experiments have been found not to be replicable. So this is not a matter of faith, it's a matter of empirical testing, just like everything else.
Thank you. The hands, I'm going to stand now because the hands are going up. So we'll take another one from the front here while the microphone's at this end, if we may. It's just gone to the back, my apologies. Anyway, here it comes again.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. My question is for Professor Tom. So you mentioned a couple of times, first you distinguish between faith and belief, said that it needs a bit of self, like kind of perception. Perception is how you have a kind of a perception which you add to faith, which is absent in belief. And then you also sort of went on to say that science needs prior belief. And I'm not quite kind of sure about what that means, because when I go to the lab, do an experiment, whether I'm happy, unhappy, sad, distressed, I don't think that actually is going to affect the outcome of my experiment. If I'm sad, jump off the cliff, I'll get hurt. If I'm happy, still the same result. So I don't see how perception can actually affect an empirical outcome. So if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, I'm maybe not quite catching the question. Are you happy to rephrase?
So the main question is that how can perception affect what I empirically observe. So faith, why is faith important in order to understand the world at all?
Okay. I've been trying to use the word belief just in a very neutral sense, just of assent to propositions, endorsing propositions. And that's both the outcome of certain kinds of empirical inquiry, and going into any inquiry, clearly we've just all got a stack of beliefs that go with us. I was then trying to distinguish two separate notions of faith, but I think there's actually three that are here in the discussion. So the first was those fundamental axioms that kind of shape the way you look at the world. And I was trying to say, look, what we need to be doing here is subjecting them to rational scrutiny. Then the other sense of faith I was using as akin to trust. So if you have faith in someone, that feels very like to trust in someone. And there's a kind of relationship, kind of attitude that's marked by. And that's a human universal, so unless you've had a really deprived, depressed childhood, everyone is capable of forming trusting relationships. Now, what's specific about the Christian or about the theist is that the person, one of the people with whom they have that relationship, is God, and that it's, in some sense, that's the most important such relationship. But everyone forms trusting relationships. Maybe what's at stake in this discussion here is this other sense of what's being called faith in some contexts. I think myself that's a slightly unhelpful term, but it's the kind of assumption that the world is... There's two assumptions. One, that the world is going to carry on working the way it always has, which does seem built into... Where the practice of science doesn't require you to have that belief, it's dependent on that. And then secondly, that mathematics is a description, an adequate, it connects with the world. That is also, there's a famous paper in the 50s called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, highlighting exactly that strange and surprising connection that there is between mathematics and the natural world. Now, whether you want to call that, I think maybe calling it faith is a slightly unhelpful, it's sort of a very loaded term, and at minimum, scientists are committed to those being working hypotheses. That's, yeah. Do you want to come back on that, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, the point is that what you're saying is that I still have to have faith that the world is going on,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I do science next morning. But let's say that I go tomorrow to Cavendish Laboratory at work, and I find that, when I shine light on the material, I don't get light out, experiments don't go, that's really interesting. So I'm going with zero prior belief. So you're right saying that I have a sense of bundle of beliefs, which I live with, but that's just Bayesian probability, so that I can actually, survive in the world better. That's going to be science. I don't think that these are science based on prior belief. Quite the opposite.
So just very quickly before I come back, absolutely, you have to. So you day one, you're shining the light in, it comes out at one angle. Day two, you go and shining out at a different angle, and not shining out at all. You don't conclude that the laws of nature have changed overnight. You conclude that either something's changed in the experimental setup, or it has to be that something's changed in the nature of the, or you're dealing with some kind of quantum level of indeterminacy. So the phenomena is explicable by some law of nature. I mean, if you don't have that assumption in place, you can't be doing science.
I would say that physics, we do not assume that laws of physics are the same. That's also subject to scrutiny. So, for example, if we believe that Newton was right, then nobody would have to do science. If there's absolutely no belief, which I think physicists go through the lab with, except that's how I think so.
Okay, I'm going to... Arif, do you want to make any comment on that discussion, or we can move on to the next question?
I think maybe isn't that perhaps good offer me to say one or two things about Tom's final
argument?
Yeah,
feel free. Yeah,
fine. Because I appreciate the comment, and I think what the question says about the Bayesian perspective is absolutely right. Tom did mention that Hume's argument has got to be wrong, because if the angel Gabriel came to me and told me that I'd been resurrected or something, then Hume would tell me I can't believe him. Well, I mean, the first thing again is that it isn't a binary question of either you completely trust this person or you just reject it out of hand. The question is, how much confidence should I put in it? Now, Hume's argument is that it should be very low. And of course it's true. If you see somebody walking down the street and he pulls a rabbit out of his ear, you don't think, oh, my eyes are telling me he must have a rabbit in his brain. You think, my eyes are probably deceiving me. Okay? So even the testimony of your senses should, of course, make you, in this case, very sceptical. If you know there are many people who have these sort of near-death experiences, mistakenly, then you should think that of yourself as well. On the point about the white whales, something similar is true. How often is it that people falsely report seeing white whales? How often is it that people truly report seeing white whales? If the first quantity is much greater than the second, then you shouldn't be very confident. But of course, if nobody's ever reported falsely or truly seeing a white whale before, then when somebody does, Hume's argument doesn't tell us to reject what he's said. So Hume's argument certainly doesn't rule out scientific discoveries that nobody's ever thought of before. Okay? I think I'll stop there.
Can I come back on
please?
I think it's really helpful. So, just a comment on the epistemology and then a question, if I may.
Yeah.
So the epistemology is, Arif was entirely right to say that not all testimony is dealt with on the basis of all-out belief or all-out scepticism. There's often degrees of belief that are involved. Now, as a statement, is often the case, that's clearly true. So that's always the case. Not so sure. So there just is this discrepancy, if you like, between two systems that we have for describing our epistemic attitudes. So Arif is...
Sorry, just for those who are not philosophers, an epistemic attitude?
So an epistemic attitude would be an attitude towards the world. So Arif is a dyed-in-the-wool Bayesian, so he never actually believes anything, he just describes credences to certain degrees. So you wear a ring, don't you? I hope your wife was assured when you took the vows that you had some kind of high level of credence in the probability of him staying married all this time. But I'm sure as well you were personally committed, but privately you sort of, you couldn't consistently with the apparatus say, oh, I believe I will still be married in 10 years. You say, oh, you know, I ascribe a 0.85 credence or something like that. So we have this kind of credence system here, which is very appropriate for scientific terminology, but tends to be, I mean, I've been slightly facetious in the example, no offence intended, but it's not very appropriate for interpersonal relationships, where we tend to then talk about, obviously we have a range of practical attitudes towards people, respect and love, etc., etc., but when we come to believe things on the basis of other people, we either believe them or not, and we often say that we know them, and knowing seems to be something that you either have, do you know a proposition? Well, yes, I either know it or I don't know it. It just seems to come. Now, how those two systems fit together is just a very complicated philosophical question, but we have these two systems, and it seems to me to be disingenuous to say that this one is the only one that counts. This one, it seems to me, also. So here's my question. What experience would you have in order for you to be a Christian or convert to another faith?
Well, the answer to that question is it would be the kind of evidence that didn't just involve testimony. It would have to involve natural traces of various sorts. So it would be the sort of evidence, as Hume said, where you're being misled by the evidence is more of a miracle than the thing that it reports, or more unlikely than the thing that it reports. And that could be, for instance, there's a story by J.G. Ballard where they describe how scientists discovered God, and what it was, they looked in the cosmic background microwave radiation, and they found underneath it there was this sort of really deep level of radiation which could respond to human thoughts and which would reveal messages to people and which would do things that obviously was coded. That's how everyone came to believe in God. So I suppose that kind of, that's just a story, but something which left natural traces rather than something which we relied only on early on testimony. And I think, as an aside, I think Bayesian marriage vows would probably improve up a number of relationships. see the benefits in them.
Okay. We won't go down that. Right. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to bring in a couple more. We have the forest of hands at one point, so perhaps we get another one from the back. There's one just here in the archway. Look, please do.
Sorry, I just wanted to continue on this question of why Hume must be wrong. And it seems to me the two cases you noted, so where, say, Gabriel appears to me, then I'd be justified in believing that there was a God, isn't analogous for the case in which we all find ourselves, where, you know, I tell you Gabriel has appeared to me. And so even if Hume's argument must be wrong in the first-person case, it's actually primarily about the testimonial case anyway, where we have to believe those kind of things on the basis of testimony. Just on the response you just gave to Arif, though, might you be conflating two senses of appropriateness? I mean, given that a third of marriages do end in divorce, it would be kind of truth-seekingly inappropriate to assume that yours wasn't, if you had no better reason to believe you were different from everybody else. But it's just kind of emotionally inappropriate to make those thoughts prior in your mind at the point at which you take those vows.
Okay, good. The first reductio, clearly Hume's argument is in relation to testimony, absolutely. But the structure of the argument is applicable also to sensory evidence. And yet it must be the case that if the Archangel Gabriel appears to you and you still I mean, plug in whatever the experience is that you think should be sufficient. Parallel reasoning says it's irrational for me to accept the conclusions of that. And so that says that there's got to be some problem going on. Now, it seems to me, if I I pass the buck, but let me just kind of explore it a bit on what has gone wrong. So Arif proposed that the basis on which we should adjudicate the probability of a miracle having occurred and the probability of testimony being false is a matter of frequency. So not very many miracles occur, lots of lies occur. People talk about things that they're sincerely misled on. There are some things which are infrequent, but yet we want to leave open the possibility of learning that they have occurred via testimony. So say, for the sake of argument, that it rains in the Sahara once every 10 years, something like that. It's not a very frequent occurrence. I still want to be able to learn from testimony that there has been rain in the Sahara. So it's not an objection, it's not a reply on behalf of Hume that in this case it's a natural event and therefore there's nothing surprising taking place. Because Hume's actually not committed to any deep claim about the metaphysics of the world. So he hasn't got any deep ontological distinction between an event that happens consistent with natural law and events which happen which break natural law. He just thinks that's the way the world works. So by his definition, rain in the Sahara is as miraculous as someone walking on water. There's no deep structural difference in terms of the reality that's going on. And yet, by the structure of Hume's arguments, it is never rational for me to believe that rain has occurred in the Sahara unless all sorts of other conditions are going to be met, simply because the frequencies don't add up in that situation. So we've got to then qualify how we're going to define probability other than through frequency in that case.
Can I comment on that briefly? I mean, we have to imagine, because the difference is we have to imagine a world where there's not just that rain in the Sahara is infrequent, but there's millions of false reports of rain in the Sahara going around. Okay, and then, of course, there are going to be some cases where we end up disbelieving a true testimony. But Hume isn't saying you're never going to avoid falsehood if you take my strategy. He's going to say if you've got two groups of people, the people who believe a testimony are going to get it wrong far more often than the people who don't believe it.
Right, so sorry, let me just it's inessential to the argument in this case that there be lots of reports to there be. So stick with the Sahara case. It's inessential to the argument that there be lots of false reports that there's rain in the Sahara. All it requires for the argument to get going is that there be sufficient numbers of false testimony. Or so you could have lots of rather. You could only ever have testimony on there being rain in the Sahara when there's actually rain in the Sahara. By the lights of Hume, if you're not able to confirm that there's that correlation between the two for yourself, because you don't have that assurance, you're still required to reject that testimony, because the category of testimony is such that there's lies and mistaken reports in that situation. So it's inessential to the rebuttal that there'd be lots of false reports of testimony. It's sufficient for Hume's argument, and this is where it goes too strong, that there'd be lies in testimony across the board. And so that's then going to show that for any infrequent, surprising event, it's always going to be irrational to believe that it's taking place. And that is what I say is an absurd conclusion, because it proves too much.
Okay, I think that's the claim I reject as to what's needed for Hume's argument. It's got to be, because how likely is it we would have been told this if it had been true? How likely is it we would have been told this if it had been false? And it's not going to be enough just that a lot of testimonies on any subject matter whatever are mistaken. But that's helpful, because I really know where we disagree.
Okay, there's time for just maybe two more questions. So let's come over here. Yep, in the far side. I could perhaps repeat this question since the microphone's going to have to travel some distance.
I mean, could be more specific in some examples of what you mean with a God, rather than generalisation. Can you give us something specific?
So is there something specific that you would need, Arif, to
to come to believe in God rather than a general notion.
An example
that might happen.
If somebody appeared in front of you, that's no good. If someone stood up and did a miracle here, that's no good. So what is it within your philosophy?
That would convince me to believe that there was a immaterial creator of the universe, or something like that. Yeah? I think it would have to be a suitable accumulation of natural evidence, which was testified, which was revealed from all over the world. The kind of thing I mentioned in the story that I described. I mean, in some ways, I can't be more specific, I guess, because I've never really thought about it in as much detail as people would have done who actually had such experiences. I mean, I can imagine the broad.
Key though, to really work out what it is.
And I can imagine the broad outlines of the kind of thing that would increase my confidence in God's existence. Certainly, I could. And that would involve things like people making predictions of earthquakes all over the world at very specific places, which then turn out to be true. Who then claim to get divine inspiration. So very specific predictions and prophecies would be a very good example of the kind of thing that would increase my confidence. I don't think anything would raise my confidence in it to absolute certainty, but then nothing would raise my confidence in anything to absolute certainty. So that's nothing special about religion. I mean, is that specific enough?
For example, the Christians claim there are 300 prophecies in the Old Testament which are fulfilled in Christ. I mean, how do you deal with that situation?
Yes, I know they believe that.
Just for the recording, so about 300 is the claim, prophecies in the Old Testament of specific and detailed things that then occur much later on, hundreds of years later. How does that chime
so
in?
So then I have to ask myself, what happens more often? Genuine prophecies that turn out to be fulfilled or false reports of genuine prophecies that turn out to be fulfilled? Everyone agrees there are loads of the latter, far more than 300,000. But very few of the former. So the answer is, I don't believe those claims.
So just suggesting is, we already have data which fits
the material. Yeah, and the answer is, we don't have the data. We have a book, or we have traces of a book, which reports those things as having happened.
Well, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls going from 50 to 150,000.
Yes, we have reports that they happened, and I'm saying those reports are false.
So you're saying they're false. You're not uncertain about that.
Yes. If there's a report in Kings, for instance, that he said a miracle would occur at such and such place and time, and it did, I'm saying I don't believe that happened. Yes.
You don't believe that that happened.
No.
So there's insufficient evidence for you to know, or it just didn't happen.
Well, my confidence in it is very low. Let me put it like that.
Okay, that's interesting. We have another question over here. Yeah.
I think really enjoyed the discussion between you. It's been really helpful.
Thank you. Wow. I really enjoyed the way you've engaged with each other. I found that very encouraging. Arif, just had a question for you on Hume's argument. Mm. I think you're getting towards it in that last answer.
Mm.
Do I understand it that your understanding of Hume's argument is primarily one of the irrationality of believing testimony about the existence of miracles rather than about the possibility of miracles in and of themselves?
Correct.
Great. So, on what basis... you've answered that, I think. The realm of the breadth and depth and frequency of, then it wouldn't be a miracle if it happened frequently.
If it happened loads, then that would defeat the point of it, I guess. Yeah.
So what I guess I'm struggling to see is on what basis Hume could believe in the existence of any one given miracle, given the definition of miracles in and of themselves. Is that fair that there aren't any circumstances under which Hume would say it's rational to believe it?
Well, the argument, as I said, concerned testimony, but it could happen. So, for instance, you could imagine a situation where there are very diverse sorts of physical traits, and the probability of all of those traces being contrived in a way that was misleading was lower than your probability of the miracle.
It's about levels of confidence.
Yes, that's right. It's never about full-out belief or full-out rejection. We never have that in this life.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Okay, great. Time for just one more, and then we will wrap it up. You're the first hand I saw, so just in here, if we could have the microphone, please. Yeah. Just in here, that's it. Thank you.
I'm sort of interested in Tom's response to the equivalent question. What would make you stop believing in God?
Well, great question. So I actually think that's So I'm going to say nothing, and I think that's defensible. And the reason it's defensible is that the evidence being historical is not the kind that is revisable. So that's part of the asymmetry between the atheistic claim and the theistic claim. So with a historical claim, the result, the historical judgment, is reproducible in the sense that the evidence, assuming that it's public, can be inspected by anyone who's going through the motions of the historian's task. But the event, being one that's happened in the past, is just the event. It either happened or it didn't happen, under whatever the description. So clearly, for any historical claim, there may be disagreement about whether the evidence, or rather what the evidence, what the conclusion is that supports, either the degree of probability or indeed the very judgment that it supports. But given the evidence, that judgment and the fact that the evidence is closed, that evidence is the conclusion is not revisable. So, I mean, were Jesus' body to turn up, that would be pretty conclusive evidence that that Christianity was false. That hasn't happened.
Thank you. That's a helpful final question. And just are either of our speakers just burning to make one final comment as we come to a conclusion?
I think it's been a very interesting and enjoyable discussion, and I want to thank the audience as well for their terrific questions.
Thank you.
At that.
Yeah, very good. Tom, a final comment? No, that's great. Well, can I thank you all very much for coming? It's the great pity, perhaps, of this evening is that we don't have John Lennox, whose lecture we have been commenting on here, to take part as well. However, perhaps one thing that was said on Friday, if not more, has been borne out by our discussion. It's been clear to me through everything that we've heard, through our discussion and through the presentations of our two speakers, that that everyone wants to esteem the value of scientific endeavour. And a large part of what John had to say on Friday night, it seems, before we got to questions about Hume and questions about miracles as they're typically discussed following Hume's argument, was about this conception that we have, perhaps, of a battle between science and faith. But it seems to me, anyway, as the chair of our discussion, that what we have seen quite clearly this evening is not really a battle between science and faith, but a battle between naturalism and theism. And so it's at that level, it's the level of our assumptions, perhaps, and our philosophical commitments, that our esteem for science needs to be understood. And so it's been a very helpful discussion around that. And so I hope it's given you pause to reflect on your own philosophical position and your own response to claims that are made about faith as well. I really want to thank this evening the organisations that have made this conversation possible, which includes Christian Heritage, who run their work here from the Round Church, and also the Veritas Forum, who helped to arrange debates and discussions of this kind. So we can give them our thanks in the usual way in a moment, and our speakers as well, but just to say for all of us that as we come to a conclusion, so we haven't quite come to a conclusion because Christian Heritage and the Veritas Forum have very kindly arranged for us a wine reception in the Cambridge Union immediately to follow this event. So when we do finish, please do proceed out of the main door, and if you turn to the right, there'll be people there to guide you on to a wine reception that we can enjoy together. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you to our speakers, to Christian Heritage and to the Veritas Forum. Thank you.